The good news is the price of oil has fallen from the stratosphere, and now you and I can afford to drive our cars to work again. That is, if we still have a job. The bad news is the ethanol industry we have built to save us from high oil prices is going bankrupt and being purchased pennies on the dollar by big oil companies. This leads us to ask, what is happening to our hope for biofuels?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the Saturday Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. This is the 625th edition of the Food Chain, and I am Michael Olson. You are tuned in to the big one here with Nikki James is on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello there.
And Parmley Taft.
Hello.
Well, folks, biofuel was to have been our great white hope. We were to, just think of it, we were to fill the heartland with corn, distill it into ethanol, and then thumb our noses at OPEC. To go for this hope, great hope, though, we passed laws mandating the use of ethanol. And we invested billions, which seems a mere trifling given what's going on in Washington these days. We invested all that money on developing a corn ethanol industry. Our efforts bore fruit as producers began operating 200 ethanol refineries across the land. But then something happened, and today 25% of the nation's ethanol industry is in danger of going bankrupt. In fact, one of the nation's biggest ethanol producers, Veresen of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, has just announced that it is selling five of its refineries to Valero Energy, the nation's largest oil refiner. Many other plants are up for sale as well, but there are few takers because the market has not placed value on these facilities. This leads us to ask, what is happening to our hope for biofuels? Here to help us find an answer, we have Jessica Resnick-Alt, who is a reporter for the Dow Jones News Service. Jessica, welcome.
Hi, Michael. Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. You're a reporter for the Dow Jones News Service. Tell us a little bit about your company.
Sure.
We don't know about the Dow Jones News Service.
I'm a reporter for Dow Jones Newswires. Mm-hmm. I'm based in Jersey City, New Jersey. Previously, I was in our Houston, Texas office covering...
Oil country.
Right, covering the gasoline capital of mm-hmm. our country. I cover independent and major oil companies with a focus on refining. I've also done a fair amount of coverage of our ethanol industry.
Mm-hmm. How did you make that transition?
As ethanol became an increasingly important part of our fuel mix, it made really a lot of sense to have the people who were covering fuel trends in the U.S. also take on a role in our ethanol coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So we do still have reporters who cover ethanol from a corn side out of Chicago, and then I cover the sort of fuel side of ethanol here out of our office, which is right near New York. We do run two weekly columns on renewable energy. The first is called Renewed Energy, which focuses primarily on biofuel, and the other is called Emission Critical, which looks at carbon release from various energy projects in the U.S. and around the globe.
Good. Who pays your way?
So Dow Jones is a unit of News Corp,
mm-hmm.
Which owns a number of outlets internationally.
So you're a real news person, aren't you?
Well, I covered news for 6 years, and certainly enjoy being a news person.
Good. Well, Jessica, the reason I ask is we always ask our people who supports them, so we get an idea. So
sure.
I guess what I'm asking is you're not being supported by a oil company or a corn.
No, of course
Good.
Not. I mean, Good. Dow Jones is an established name in journalism and operates The Wire as well as the Wall Street Journal newspaper.
Right. Good.
So.
Well, also with us today, we have David Bloom, who's author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Where'd you come up with that title, David?
Oh, we came up with it some years ago when we were drafting the book because it was our firm opinion that if you can't make people laugh, they won't take you seriously.
That's right. Were you drinking a glass of wine or something?
I am definitely an alcohol professional, but I am very much involved in Fuel.
Okay, good. Well, it's been just a few months since we last joined here on the Food Chain. And the last time we were together, you talked about how the oil industry appeared to be gaming the corn industry. And I thought, oh, gosh, David, you got to be pulling my leg here. But we're back, and it appears that maybe you weren't pulling my leg after all.
Well, yeah, Michael, basically, looking at what's gone on over the last year, it really followed the predictions that I made in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which it was too ripe an opportunity not to take advantage of. And there's a long history of oil companies working pretty big operations to affect what fuel that we have available. I mean, I would point back to in the 1930s, the first media saturation bombing that was ever attempted was done by the American Petroleum Institute. And that was to nail the alcohol industry back then, which had come back strong in the wake of the Depression. The Agrol company in the Midwest had over 2,000 stations across the Midwest selling alcohol, and their primary customers were farmers.
You mean back in 1930s, there were 2,000 alcohol distillers in the...
There were actually many more thousand stations, but 2,000 were owned by the Agrol company, which was the biggest distributor at the time. And what happened was the oil companies took the strategy of we have to separate the support for alcohol from the fuel, which at that time was the farm community. So they put together the first, you know, really massive PR bombing of the press. Mm-hmm. And so they delivered on the same day, remember this is prior to the internet, press releases to every newspaper and every radio station across the country, which said that Agrol was secretly buying Caribbean alcohol and not buying American grain to make fuel with. And of course, well, it must be true. It was in every newspaper, and so everyone boycotted Agrol. And in 6 weeks, they were bankrupt. But the point was, there was never any truth to the story. It was completely fabricated. And so this kind of hard-knuckle battle for the hearts and minds of Americans in the press is something that's gone on for a long time with the oil companies. And this current situation is the fruit of a year-long campaign to convince Americans that ethanol is a bad idea.
Well, we're going to get into that, but I asked Jessica, so I'll ask you, who supports you, and given what you just said, I don't suspect it's the oil companies.
No, it's not the oil companies, and in fact, we don't receive funding from any institutions whatsoever. We're an independent institute, the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture, and we're pretty much supported by people who hire us to consult on alcohol projects. These are all small projects, less than 1 million gallons a year usually. And, of course, revenues from Alcohol Can Be a Gas, our book on the subject.
Well, it sounds like we have a couple of good guests who don't have any particular axe to grind, so away we go. For start, let's start with talk about what on earth is happening with our ethanol industry. Valero buys Verison. Jessica, let's start with you.
Well, I think we really need to go back to 2005 to understand this, Michael, because what happened at that point was refiners were asked to stop using MTBE, a component that had been added to gasoline.
And MTBE is something that's really big here in California. I think we still have it in our gasoline, don't we?
No, we were the first to get rid of it.
Oh, we were the first to get rid of it? Okay.
Right. MTBE, California was one of the states that had led the charge against MTBE, because there was a concern that it was contaminating water supply when it leached out of gasoline tanks. So as a result, MTBE was cut and refiners needed a substitute component. Ethanol began to gain popularity at that point.
Yeah, but before you go on, why did we need something else in gasoline other than gasoline?
Gasoline, what you and I know as gasoline, what we pump into our cars, is made from a number of different components, different chemicals, naphtha, and a number of sort of
400 different components?
Sure. A number of components that we know as gasoline. So the result is when MTBE was eliminated as one of those components, refiners needed something to provide to sort of provide the service that MTBE had provided in the gasoline, which was to serve as what they call an oxygenate.
Okay. What does an oxygenate do, David?
Well, the idea is that if you burn a hydrocarbon, you get a lot of carbon monoxide, which in cities is quite toxic. It takes the place of oxygen in your blood. And so by adding oxygen in the form of either alcohol or MTBE, you get better combustion, less pollution, less toxic pollution. And that had been mandated by Congress for quite a while that we had to reduce those pollutants.
So it's a pollution issue then that we add the MTBE and then ethanol.
And ethanol was the preferred solution, but the oil companies fought that and said, you can't tell us what to put in our fuel as long as we meet the spec. So they used MTBE.
Good, folks. You're tuning into the Food Chain. Right now we're talking about what happened or what is happening to our ethanol industry. The industry we spent billions developing is now eroding like or evaporating kind of like snow in July. What is going on? What's happening? We're talking with Jessica Resnick-Alt, a reporter for the Dow Jones Newswire, David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, holy smokes, the nation's largest refiner of oil has just purchased five of the refineries of the nation's largest producer of ethanol. What is happening to the ethanol that you and I have invested billions of dollars in building? Is it disappearing? Is it going broke? We're finding out today. And right now we're talking about what happened to our ethanol industry. We're starting back in 2005. And with us today, we have Jessica Resnick-Alt, a reporter for the Dow Jones Newswire, and also David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Jessica, we're talking about 2005. They took away our MTBE and said we have to use ethanol, but I bet the oil industry didn't like that, did they, David?
Well, they had been fighting it tooth and nail, but once Tom DeLay's attempt to have liability exempted for MTBE failed, they saw the writing on the wall and that, you know, the water pollution being caused by MTBE was going to cost them money. So they voluntarily at that point pulled out of the MTBE addition.
Okay. So MTBE was something they could make.
And it's a byproduct, actually, from two or three different refineries around the world. And you got to realize, to some degree, gasoline is a way of disposing of refinery toxic waste. You know, it's like we get the privilege of paying to burn that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so MTBE was a surplus from making something else, but it had the aspect of having oxygen in it, but it had the bad form to be water-soluble. So if it spilled in the ground, it would travel for miles.
Rocket fuel in the water.
Yeah, I think the classic study was a pickup truck that rolled over in 20 gallons, you know, soaked into the ground, and they found it, a plume of it, a kilometer away. So it was that mobile in the environment. So it was always a bad idea to use it, but they did it so they wouldn't have to use ethanol.
Jessica, they made us take away the MTBE and substituted ethanol, right?
Well, the other really critical component that we have to look at in 2005 was the renewable fuels mandate, which was passed by Congress at that point as part of an energy bill that was adopted in 2005. And that bill, Michael, was really critical in initiating the incorporation of ethanol into our gasoline supply.
Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, you have to use it. There you go.
You have to use it. And mm-hmm. in 2007, sort of the real I guess the real sealing of the deal happened because the second renewable fuel standard was passed, suggesting that gasoline producers would have to ramp up their use of ethanol and other biofuels, reaching a total of 36 billion gallons a year by 2022.
Okay, a quick parenthetical. What are the other biofuels?
Right now, other biofuels that are widely available primarily consist of biodiesel.
Mm-hmm.
There is a push toward creating ethanol and other biofuels from a variety of other
cellulosic
plants
ethanol.
Other than corn. Sure, there's cellulosic ethanol, mm-hmm. which would be made from parts of corn or other crops that are not generally used for food. And another option that's been considered is biobutanol, which is a fuel that is ethanol-like but can go through our pipeline system, which ethanol can't generally.
You know, actually, Jessica, on the pipeline issue, the oil companies have been saying for a long time that our pipeline system isn't designed to take ethanol because ethanol absorbs water.
Mm-hmm.
But in preparation for this buying of the alcohol plants, Shell had Kinder Morgan do a pipeline test. It's one of the bigger pipeline companies, 6 weeks ago. And this was one of the signals that the oil companies were about to go into the alcohol business because they did a pipeline test and said, well, gosh, it worked just fine. There were no problems at all.
But David, to be clear, that's going to be different from the sort of common carrier pipelines that most of our system is comprised of.
Meaning?
Generally, you have these pipelines that carry a number of things, not just gasoline, but also diesel, jet fuel, et cetera. And I think the push on ethanol pipelines has been to design a pipeline that is specifically used for ethanol.
Okay. So at any rate, we have an industry that is under federal mandates, one, to get rid of MTBE, and two, to use more biofuels.
Right.
And away we go. So what happened to the industry?
So at that point, spurred by these federal mandates, we saw a huge buildup of ethanol capacity in the United States. There had been some plants that had been around for a long time, some of the ones that David had mentioned before. There are plants with 20, 30, or longer year trajectories producing this fuel. Fairly storied history. For example, in Pekin, Illinois, there's a plant currently owned by Aventine that's been operating for more than 26 years.
Wow. Selling their ethanol to?
Well, they sell 99% of the ethanol in the country to the oil companies as an additive. Only a very small amount is sold as E85 or relatively straight alcohol at the pump. So really, the alcohol business has one customer, which is
the oil company,
which is the collective oil companies, yes.
Okay. Sure, and I just wanted to jump in here and describe some of the major users of ethanol. When we talk about the oil companies, we're talking about a number of different kinds of companies. You have companies like Valero, which Michael had mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
which is a independent refiner.
Mm-hmm.
Their primary job is to produce gasoline, diesel, and other fuels. They don't actually make any of their own oil. And then you have companies like Shell, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, some of the more household names, which do produce their own fuel, but also produce oil that they refine into that fuel.
When you say produce oil, what do you mean?
I mean they have global operations where they
pump it out of the ground.
Explore, right.
Okay.
They find oil.
Good
so
enough.
There's an exploration process as well as a production.
I was just trying to figure out how they made oil. So
sure,
just
kidding.
So we have quite an industry going right now, or we had quite an industry going. Take us back a few months now, Jessica, and tell us what happened to oil that it shot from $40 to $150 a barrel. What happened?
There are a number of theories on what happened. Obviously, some people have blamed speculators in the marketplace. Others have suggested that there were supply and demand dynamics that pushed oil upward.
What do you think, Jessica?
Well, Michael, I'm not the primary reporter covering the actual
price fluctuations,
but certainly, you know, it's a great question. And we've written a lot, you know, exploring a number of possibilities. Certainly there are funds that had speculated, and there are others who were looking primarily at supply-demand disruptions. Currently, we certainly see fundamentals moving the market on a daily basis. We see concerns, for example, over China or India and their burgeoning demand as factors that might drive up oil. This summer, one of the things that we saw was China was buying a great deal of diesel fuel and trying to manufacture a maximum amount of diesel fuel ahead of its hosting of the Olympic Games. So there are physical factors like that that certainly played into the market.
David, what did oil go from $40 a barrel to $150?
Well, I think some of the considerations there are, as Jessica points out, there are some supply and demand issues and maybe a little speculation. But there's also a longer-term pattern that has to do with politics. If you look back over the last 10 or 11 elections, you'll often see the price peaking in the summer before the election and then dropping right during the election. And we've published some graphs on that on our website at Alcohol Can Be a Gas. So, for instance, 2006 election, starting in August, the price began to go down and down and down and down until November 7th, in which that very day the price started going back up and up and up and up. So there is a long-term political pattern where oil companies
Can they change things that drastically from like $40 a barrel to $150 a barrel?
Yeah, for gasoline or for oil, yes, that can go on, and it has to do with a lot of factors, as Jessica pointed out. And part of the problem is we really aren't pumping any more oil now than we did 3 years ago. We're not increasing supply, and that can really cause spikes in price.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would like to ask Jessica and David what happened to the price of corn when the price of oil went through the roof. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about what is happening to our hope for biofuels. We have Jessica Resnick Alt from the Dow Jones Newswire and David Bloom, who is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and we have you. Do stay tuned. Hey, what on earth is happening to our hope for a biofuels industry? That's what we're working with right now. We have Jessica Resnick Alt, a reporter for the Dow Jones News Service. We have David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and we are talking about how we have a great industry that was built up. We had 200 refineries going, and all of a sudden something happened. And what happened, Jessica?
Well, I think one of the things that happened, Michael, is that the corporate structure of the companies that had started, that had been leading the ethanol production resurgence, really started to fail. There were a number of reasons for those failures, which I'm sure David and I will hit on. But I think it's important to note that even as these companies have failed, we've continued to produce ethanol. Mm-hmm. The actual production of ethanol has not stopped. Right now, we're producing roughly 10.46 billion gallons a year of ethanol.
Still cranking out the juice, then.
We are.
We are good. So what is happening with the ownership is changing, but the hotel's still open for business.
And that's exactly it. And it's something we've certainly seen in other industries. We've seen reorganization in conventional gasoline, mm-hmm. in airlines. These are all the sort of corporate transactions that we tend to be fairly familiar with. You know, mm-hmm. Pan Am no longer flies, but you can still get on an airplane.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the price of corn when the price of oil went through the roof?
Well, I think it's important to look at them as separate variables, and actually that's one of the things that has really squeezed ethanol producers, that they have to deal with these two totally separate markets. But corn also did rise. We saw a major spike in June, slightly before oil prices spiked. And the reason for that spike was largely concerns over Midwest flooding.
Mm-hmm.
So as the Midwest became totally flooded in mid-June, late June, we saw corn prices reach really an unseen-before high as people were concerned about corn supply and what would happen during this year's harvest.
David?
Well, I'm really glad, Jessica, that you're pointing to reasons that weren't widely reported. You know, the wide report was that ethanol demand was causing the price of corn to go up, and that had saturated the media. So from where I was standing, it looked to me like an impossible situation, because the price of corn went up even though we had an enormous surplus of corn from the year's harvest. We had a 1.6 billion bushels of surplus corn that no one bought, the ethanol producers, neither the food industry. So in theory, the price of corn should have gone down, as would happen during any surplus. But we were fed a constant diet of stories saying that the demand for ethanol was driving up the price of corn. And what it sure looked like, and what we predicted actually in advance on this very show, Larry Mitchell and I were here some months ago, and we said what we expect is that the oil companies will crank up the price of corn and depress the price of alcohol, and that's what we saw.
That was June of last year.
A whole year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something, David, to be said for some of the points you're making, but I do want to clarify what the link would be between the oil companies and the price of corn. Can you just elaborate on that?
Oh, sure. So basically, the commodities future trading system is completely, or very much completely, unregulated. You can't track who does the trading. You can't track who loses money.
Hey, it's just like money market funds.
Oh, maybe worse. And so what we have been led to believe from people inside who would give us calls is that the oil companies were doing a pretty good job buying futures contracts at high prices.
Of oil or of corn?
Of corn. And that caused a follow-on effect from speculators, but the main buys were OPEC investors and oil company investors. So they drove up the price of corn pretty well. And you got to realize last year's profits collectively for the oil industry were over $125 billion. So $2 or $3 billion worth of futures purchases could easily lead this charge up. But you can't prove it because you can't record who actually does those trades. At the same time that they were, in essence, giving farmers more money for their corn by buying that corn on a futures contract, they quadrupled the price of fertilizer, which is way beyond the actual increase in natural gas price, which is what fertilizer is made from. So they gave to the farmers with one hand, took with the others, but they're still left an overhang where they had put in more money than they had taken out. But we also noticed, for instance, that the food companies, Kraft and Kellogg's and all these companies that buy the corn, instead of seeing a drop in profits because of the upward spiraling price of corn, they actually increased their profits 84 to 120%. So we're pretty sure that the oil companies were selling their contracts into the food system at the usual price of $3 a bushel and taking the loss. And what it did, the effect was it completely dried up investment into alcohol fuel, because on paper, a venture capitalist couldn't see putting the money into alcohol when the return was only 12%, when a year before the return was 100%. We had the amount of capital going into alcohol in the prior year, looking at things like in Iowa getting $3 billion worth of investment capital, when the state of New York, total state of New York, only got $2.9 billion worth of investment capital. That's an enormous amount of money to be going into an industry that was threatening to take a chunk out of the income for the oil companies. It's unimaginable that they wouldn't do something about that, and we're pretty clear that we predicted in advance this is what would happen. It's because corn is a commodity and can be bought and sold in the futures market that it's able to be manipulated, just like alcohol fuel.
Well, is oil a commodity too?
Oil is a commodity, Michael, but I do want to go back to this idea of the oil companies gaming corn. I've certainly gone through the earnings reports from many of the oil companies, and I don't think that this investment in the corn market is something that has come up generally in those annual reports or quarterly reports. So while this is a theory that is out there by David and perhaps by others, I don't think it's necessarily the dominant theory in this case as to why corn prices were going up or as to who the players were.
Good. Well, wouldn't it make sense for a giant fuel oil refiner like Valero to buy a bunch of ethanol plants at pennies on the dollar just to get
ethanol? It does make sense for them to do that. And the reason that makes so much sense is earlier in the show, we were talking about the energy bills of 2005 and 2007. And those energy bills, which require the use of ethanol, do not require a sheer production of ethanol, but rather require the oil companies and the gasoline blenders in particular to add ethanol to the gasoline they're producing. So in other words, for 2008, there was a 9 billion gallon a year ethanol mandate. That does not mean that ethanol companies needed to produce 9 billion gallons a year. It means that oil companies needed to buy 9 billion gallons a year. So I think that's a really important distinction, because if you're being forced to suddenly add this component to your fuel mix, it makes sense that you'd want to control the price of that by manufacturing it yourself, just as you manufacture naphtha or the other components that you're putting into gasoline.
And controlling the price is what it's all about. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking ethanol and fuel with Jessica Resnick-Alt and David Bloom right back. Do stay tuned. Well, when it gets right down to it, oil is a commodity, and so is corn. And in a way, we're competing against each other for the fuel in our car and the fuels of our future. So we wonder, is it an ethical or against the law for one industry, the participants of one industry like oil, to game the marketplace for the other, like corn? Would it be against the law for something like that, Jessica?
Certainly not. In fact, it's long been a part of the ethanol industry, Michael, that there has been funding from and ownership by the oil companies. For example, in the 1970s, when ethanol began to gain a lot of traction due to high oil prices, we saw Chevron, Ashland, and Texaco each buy an ethanol plant. Ultimately, those companies sold their plants, or the plants folded as ethanol took a downturn. However, certainly there is a precedent for this.
Okay, good. David?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to pay attention to is there's a couple of things we need to pay attention to. One is, it's not maybe not illegal. For instance, it wasn't illegal for John Rockefeller to fund the women's Christian temperance movement to the tune of $4 million and then basically buy Congress to pass prohibition, which took alcohol off the market for more than a dozen years. So, yes, you know, we live in a country where...
Wait a minute. What are you saying here?
Oh, prohibition was well-documented, completely funded by Rockefeller to take alcohol off the market. It was equal
and
to
Rockefeller
gasoline.
Owned?
Well, Standard Oil.
Okay.
You know, and so it was basically half the market was alcohol and half was
Are you
gasoline.
Saying that John D. Rockefeller was gaming the corn market?
No, what I'm trying to point out is he was able to use politics and to game the fuel market and basically monopolize it. But I'm just pointing that out because it wasn't illegal. It just was possibly unethical. But I think where we got to go is encouraging competition in the fuel market, because where the oil companies are going next is oil shale, more tar sands, and coal to gasoline, or as at one conference I went to, turning actual wood into synthetic gasoline. These are all going to cost a lot of money, $100, $150 a barrel. Alcohol produced from a wide variety of crops, not just corn, say sweet sorghum or fodder beets or things that are not commodities, so they'd be hard to control, can really reliably be produced profitably for $50 a barrel. So if we actually get an alcohol industry off the ground here, the oil companies won't be able to develop these other synthetic fuel businesses because they'll be more expensive. And everything they can do to stop ethanol from getting off the ground now is part of that future strategy.
Jessica?
I guess there are a number of points that David has just raised, but I think that some of them have more validity than others. I certainly don't see it as immoral by any stretch of the imagination for the gasoline producers to produce ethanol as well. It makes a lot of sense to me, just as a gasoline producer would operate his entire refinery. It makes sense that he would also operate a unit that would produce ethanol, which has become a component of that gasoline, a federally mandated component. To me, that doesn't speak to a demise in the alcohol industry, as David referred to it, but rather as a change in ownership. It certainly does not appear that Valero has bought the five Verison plants with the intent of shuttering them. In fact,
no,
because of Verison...
No, I agree with you, Jessica, that part is neutral. It's not who owns
sure.
them is neutral. But you see, what will happen when they buy those plants is that it's already been established that they're going to renege on the contracts to the farmers for the corn.
How can they do that?
They got that passed in bankruptcy court. And then what happens after
you mean
that?
I just want to clarify, generally when a company does go through the Chapter 11 filing, all sorts of contracts are nullified. We've certainly seen that with union contracts. We've seen that in the bankruptcy of an oil company, LyondellBasell. They've been trying to renegotiate some of their contracts. They're an oil refiner and chemical company. I don't think that it's unusual.
But the reneging on corn futures contracts has never been done, and this is a new precedent. What everybody is concerned about, and this is where I start to worry about the morality, is, and morality is a slippery thing, but basically if they buy the alcohol plants, that's one thing, but then if they bankrupt the farmers in the process and then buy their land, now we're looking at a situation where we're talking about oil companies controlling our food and fuel and land, and that looks like the kind of monopoly that doesn't serve anybody. Competition is a better tool for us in capitalism, and basically for the alcohol industry to be able to compete with oil.
Do you see any evidence
of that? You have to be able to provide some protection from the capital advantage oil companies can bring to bear in the market.
Do you see any advantages of oil companies wanting to take over farmland like you just suggested?
Huh. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking right now at a conference I just was at. Chevron wants to hook up with Weyerhaeuser to turn trees into synthetic gasoline. Honeywell and DuPont were talking about turning farms into producing hay for cellulosic gasoline, which they call cellulosic biofuel. They're not interested in going to alcohol. Even though alcohol opens up the market to a wide range of players, like farmers, et cetera, the oil companies don't want to see that happen, and that's why we need to push for that.
Okay, folks, can you hold on for one second, Jessica? We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask both Jessica and David the question of the day. Can we escape the commodity cycle that holds us in bondage to those who have the commodities? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We are talking the hope for biofuels with Jessica Resnick-Ault and David Bloom and you. We don't have much time for phone calls, but we're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, oil is a commodity and corn is a commodity. And the question of the day, or of the year, of the century, of the millennium, can we escape the commodity cycle that controls our lives? Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're just finishing up. Jessica, you have the word here. Go ahead.
Well, I think that certainly both corn and oil are commodities, there's no question. And given the way they're traded right now, I do think that ethanol producers can be squeezed between the two. I think that there is a way for ethanol producers to smartly manage their risk in both markets.
How?
There are a number of hedging instruments that can be used. One of the things that was seen as a factor in Verison's bankruptcy was their use of a particularly risky instrument known as a corn accumulator contract.
Oh, those corn accumulators will get you every time.
Right, and I think it's widely known that if you're putting a corn accumulator or other risky instrument like that in place, you need to have a fairly comprehensive strategy with other tools to balance out the...
Like a lot of money in your pocket, maybe?
There are a number of ways to manage risk, Michael. I don't think it's just a question of being a billionaire with a an ethanol company.
And, you know, that's what farmers always do is manage risk, right? That's the nature of good farming.
Sure, and I think it's the nature of good business management in a commodities commodities business, any commodities business. And in our coverage of accumulator contracts, we had covered a number of ways that these tools can be used a little more smartly, a little more intelligently to manage risk. And I think in Verisun's case, perhaps they failed to do that. You know, as corn prices were going way up this summer, they got locked in to a position where they had to buy a fairly high volume of corn at a price that was higher than the market value of the commodity.
And there you go. David Bloom, thank you, Jessica. Hold on for a minute now. David Bloom, is there a way to escape the commodity cycle that holds us in such chains? Oops, just a sec here. There, go ahead.
Absolutely. And in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, I point out that relying on a single product like corn, especially one that's traded, is risky for any business having a single input, and even worse is having a single customer. I mean, most of us in small business know having a diversity of customers protects us from unreasonable problems. So what I propose is that we move out of corn, and everyone agrees on that. So we're talking about not too many exotic crops like cellulose, because the patents for cellulose will, quite frankly, be owned by the oil companies.
So that'll become a commodity as well.
Yeah. So what we want to do is have farmers grow a wide variety of crops, sweet sorghum, beets, even things like Jerusalem artichokes, and they can be grown all around the country. Some of them are very profitable, like cattails, which wouldn't be thought of a crop that give you 7,000 gallons an acre instead of 250. The point of all these, though, is that the farmers can sell that alcohol, produce it themselves on the reasonable scale, not the 100 million gallon per year plant, so they're nimble and able to change with whatever input is available, and sell that alcohol locally as E85. So they are
diversification.
Always
the best strategy.
And that's why we're working with American corn growers to diversify both the sales and the production methodology so that nobody can game them.
Amen. So Jessica Resnick-Alt and David Bloom, thank you both so much for joining us. What do you think out there is what is happening to our hope for biofuels? I'm sorry about all of you that are hanging on the phone. You can join the discussion by going to the forums page at metrofarm.com. See you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.